This is CliffCentral.com.
Welcome to the Renegade Report. I'm Jonathan.
And Roman is present. However, I think I identify as the official Grand Wizard of the alt-right, South African branch.
Well, I'm the official Jew of the alt-right.
Well, treasurer, I would think.
Yes, there's that latent anti-Semitism.
I mean, are Jews allowed in the alt-right? Are Jews allowed? I mean, we still need to speak to stakeholders and look at the processes.
We do need to get hold of certain alt-right members in the US. Are hard to track down.
Well, you know. No, you just go to 4chan. They're all right there. We just need to up our meme game.
Yeah, so according to Virashni, it's got a very white surname. What is it again?
Hutchinson.
Yes, that's it. According to Virashni Hutchinson, former editor of the Huffington Post.
And Mail and Guardian.
We are the alt-right. The alt-right in South Africa, apparently, because we disagree with her. In fact, we don't actually disagree with her. That's a weird thing.
No, I don't think what she writes or the blog that she endorsed was hate speech.
Yeah.
We said so numerous times.
So we, in her little inquiry or whatever it would be called, her case, we're on her side.
We're trying to be like white allies here to the social justice cause. And then she still like calls us alt-right. I mean, really, ungrateful is what I say.
How was sitting in court for a pseudo court for an afternoon with a whole bunch of white men, rich white men, berating white privilege? How was that?
Quite infuriating. I actually just wanted to stand up and say, you're all rich white men here talking about white privilege. Why don't you just remove yourself and let a POC take your place? Like, why don't you do that? But I couldn't, obviously. I would have been arrested, I suppose.
Can they arrest you? Do they have that power?
Well, now I'm a member of the alt-right. We have more power than ever.
Well, on that note, all our power, let's discuss some movements politically overseas. We've discussed it before.
So we've got a member of the English alt-right in studio. Well, I don't know
He's going to deny that.
Right.
Vociferously. Right. Simon, welcome to the show. We've got Simon.
Great to be here.
Simon Gordon on the show. Do you want to tell our audience a bit about you?
Up till the general election a couple of months ago, I was working for Douglas Carswell, who was the only MP in that parliament for the UK Independence Party and a member of Vote Leave, which was the official organisation designated by the Electoral Commission to campaign for Brexit.
You're not making a good case against the alt-right thing so far. So far, you're losing.
Yeah, I don't know if I would define myself like that.
No, sure.
But it's not about defining yourself. It's about what other people say about you.
Indeed.
That's how you get defined, Simon.
Yes, it's how they malign you.
Right. So Brexit, I mean, a small issue at the end of the day when it happened. We weren't too worried about it.
Well, we were quite pro-Brexit. We thought it would happen. Obviously, the polls said it wouldn't. And we were like, no, we're pretty sure it will. So we were quite chuffed with that. Do you want to tell us a little bit about the history? Because I think for most people, it really starts, you know, last year, the year before. But actually, you've got this sort of encroaching EU body over decades, which kind of led to Brexit.
Yeah, the story of European political union begins back in the 50s, but Britain didn't join until the early 1970s. Hmm. And there was a referendum in 1975 on whether to stay in the union that had been joined without democratic consent or whether to leave. And that was framed as a trading relationship at the time. It was the EEC, European Economic Community. So, and that, I think, is how British people have always seen it. And I think to understand Brexit, you have to appreciate that no one in Britain really wants to go into political union. And yet over the years, that's what the European Union has become. It has all the trappings of a state. It has its own president, has a parliament, council of ministers, has its own effectively foreign secretary. It has a foreign policy spokesperson. And it also regulates for the continent. So product regulations, everything from the environment to fisheries, agriculture, which is vastly subsidized. So it actually has a huge amount of regulatory power, all of which is with very, very limited democratic consent.
And they want to establish a military, as far as I understand.
That has been discussed, yeah.
So, total control.
So it's a proto multinational state, in essence.
Well, the direction of travel seems to be towards a super state, yes. I mean, it has its own currency for those that are part of the Eurozone, which is why it would make it very, very difficult for a country that was within the Eurozone to do what Britain has done.
Right. So, but the EU is not all bad, though. I mean, there are some good things. I mean, when I travel Europe on my EU passport, it's quite nice just to drive between various countries without worrying too much about border posts, I suppose. That's one positive thing.
Well, it's positive for, I suppose it is convenient for tourists. It's also convenient for terrorists. I mean, you know.
You can't tell them apart sometimes.
Well, that's part of the issue. You can't do the border checks to do so. But I mean, the terror attacks in France last year, for example, I mean, there was a lot of coordination from Molenbeek in Brussels.
Right.
So that kind of network is easier when there are no border controls. And of course, that spans an entire continent, pretty much. And when there are migrant flows from North Africa through Italy, that means, you know, as soon as you're in Italy, you can make it through to Calais. And that, to a certain extent, encourages the flow. It enables the flow of migrants. And it's not clear that the continent has any idea how to deal with that. I mean, demonstrably, so far, it has no idea. But.
Yes. I mean, we'll get to immigration a bit later. But I just want to know from you, when you campaign for Brexit, what were the main issues at play? Like, what did you think the electorate will want to know about the EU that maybe they weren't aware of, or they were aware of, but they thought it was quite benign, but perhaps very important?
Yeah, the biggest issue in the campaign for Vote Leave, which was the official campaigning organisation, was sovereignty. And that was framed as control. So the slogan we used was take back control. And that proved popular because people don't really want to be governed either by a government which, you know, they haven't given consent to, or actually by a government which is in a foreign country doesn't necessarily have their best interests at heart. Immigration was also a concern. The economy was a concern, but the way it was framed didn't seem like it was economics to the other campaign, to the Remain campaign. So it was framed as, you know, we send a certain amount of money to the EU every week, £350 million gross per week. Imagine if we spent that money here on our public services. And you can say, well, you know, if you're a libertarian, I would find myself as a libertarian, you know, rather than alt-right. But, you know, would you necessarily want to take that money and spend it on, say, the National Health Service without any kind of reform, without thinking, well, maybe it could be tax cuts, maybe it could be anything else. But I think the point is anyone would agree that, you know, it's not worth giving to the European Commission in order that it can spend it on lavish new buildings and pretty lavish salaries for its own employees.
So what has the EU done for Britain in the past few decades that have been beneficial? I mean, there has to be some sort of merit to the existence.
The reason that Britain joined was to have free trade with Europe. And hopefully, pending the results of the negotiations, we will still have free trade with Europe after Brexit. So the question is, you know, is political union necessary for trade? I mean, you'd say, no, we trade with the United States, don't have political union without the United States.
Switzerland is not part of the EU.
No, but Switzerland has so many bilateral agreements with the EU that it's difficult to... to a certain extent, they have surrendered sovereignty as well. So I think what Britain is aiming for in these negotiations, in the Brexit negotiations, is a deal somewhere between Canada and Switzerland.
Okay. So still their own country, but...
But in answer to your question, I mean, but basically the benefit for Britain is about trade, but it's questionable to what extent we needed to be part of the European Union in order to get the trading relationship that we wanted. And you also have to compare Britain in the 1970s to Britain today. I mean, Britain was the sick man of Europe in the 1970s. You know, there were, you know, the three-day week and, you know, strikes, industrial decline. And looking across the channel, you know, Europe seemed to be pretty prosperous, but that's kind of reversed with the Eurozone crisis. Not that Britain doesn't have its own serious economic problems, but the Eurozone doesn't look particularly prosperous at the moment. And Britain's trade with the rest of the world has increased relative to Britain's exports to the rest of the world are now greater than its exports to the EU. And that's something that's happened over the past 15 years, pretty much. It's now a majority of Britain's exports go to non-EU countries.
In terms of the regulations that a body like the EU would set up, is it even possible in your mind? You said you're a libertarian, but is it even, if you try to imagine, possible that a centralized government like that could act in the best interests of any country, because it would seem to me that if you make fishing rules, legislation, regulations, whatever it happens to be, for Italy, that may work very well for Italy and may have been done with all the best of intentions. We've discussed intentions on the show before. It may have been done with all the best intentions for Italy, but the effect in Britain may be completely opposite. And I do understand that there were some examples like that in things like
yeah, there's quite a good example, I think, would be ports. So there's something called the Port Services Regulation. I don't know how technically you want to...
Yeah, be technical.
Well, I'll see how much technical detail I can remember.
Very intelligent listeners, so go for it.
So the Port Services Regulation intends to create internal competition for services within ports, and it's really designed for big state-owned ports in Europe. But Britain's ports are mostly smaller and privately owned. And if you impose competition on these in services within these ports, then you destroy their economies of scale. So that's one. That's one example of a regulation that doesn't really work for every country in the EU. It's also not really necessary. And I think the basic question is, why do you need a single regulatory system in order to permit trade?
Yeah. I'm trying to get to, you know, if there's a listener who feels we're wrong on Brexit, who feels no, we really should be moving towards something like the EU. They will have been told all the things that the Remain side has told them, which is the EU came about after World War II. It was a way of keeping peace and stability in the European Union. It succeeded at doing that.
Did it?
Well, I'm saying...
I actually think that is the... if you were to make an argument for the EU... Which, by the way, the Remain campaign never really did. All they said was that it would be too expensive to leave.
Yes.
They never actually advanced a positive argument, which is part of the reason why they lost.
Mm.
But if you were to make a case for the EU, the case that I think would play best in continental Europe is the one about peace. And I don't really think that holds up either, considering that half of Europe was at war with the other half for most of the period from the end of the Second World War through to the fall of the Soviet Union.
Mm.
So Europe was divided against itself then, and what united Western Europe was opposition to the Soviet Union.
Yeah, and it took sort of outside European influence to assist in that process anyway.
And not all European countries were actually unified in that effort, particularly France with its kind of non-aligned third way thing.
Sure. All right, so that's the one argument. The peace is the one argument. The other one was the economic argument. It's too expensive, as you mentioned. What do you make of that? There's been sort of conflicting data since, and conflicting interpretations of the data since. So people will say, for example, the FTSE's gone up, and they'll go, yes, it's gone up because the pound's gone down.
Yeah, I mean, the economic data in Britain has been much as it was in 2016. What was predicted by the Chancellor of the Exchequer, who was a leading voice in the Remain campaign, was a contraction in GDP of about 3.6%, which would be in a recession, unemployment going up, markets falling, foreign direct investment falling. But really, none of that's happened. I mean, you know, growth this year, I think, is about 1.7%. It's not great. It's about the same as it was last year. And I think that's because, you know, markets haven't really been spooked by this. It's certainly not true that confidence is plummeting. If you look at the, it's called the Manufacturers Purchasing Index, which tracks demand for manufactured products in the UK, that's... I think most recent figures, it's 55, which apparently is, you know, best for a long time. It's good.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, the fundamental economic problems in Britain aren't necessarily linked to Brexit. I mean, the big problem is consumer credit. It's interest rates that are far too low, an economy that is sustained with far too much borrowing. But in terms of the European Union, you know, there are opportunities to be gained from... potentially from deregulating and also from leaving the customs union and signing free trade agreements with other countries in the world, and also just not having to impose tariffs at all. So we could have no tariffs whatsoever on imports, which would make, say, food prices, wine prices, a lot cheaper than they are now.
Okay, so cool. We've gone through peace as the one excuse. We've gone through the economy as the other excuse. And then...
No, the third excuse, if I may. Sorry,
yes.
People are just too stupid to know what was actually being said. And they were duped by people like you, Simon, who wrote these grand speeches about sovereignty and hating Arabs. That people were just duped. They didn't know what they were doing. So we need a second Brexit, a second referendum, rather, to get
Yeah, I mean, what's remarkable
result.
Is that pro-Remain people still make that argument, and they don't realize that it was because they were making that argument during the campaign. That
can we call them Remain, please?
Yeah, like, the Ramoners.
The Ramoners. Yeah. It's a better title.
So they seem to be oblivious to the fact that people don't like to be called idiots. Made a conscious decision to put an X in a box.
If you condescend to people and you patronize them and you tell them that they're morons, then they don't tend to support you. I mean,
yeah, Ramon brings the point of calling people dolts in terms of voting for the Brexit. But I think it goes a step further than that. And you know, with you being involved somewhat in the UKIP side of things, or certainly with one of the MPs for UKIP, you can perhaps shed more light on this, which is, once you go to the actual arguments and those arguments sort of fall flat, the economic argument, the peace argument, you have to be part of this union from a legislation or regulation perspective, they then turn to the inevitable sort of argument, or it's not even an argument, it's an ad hominem, which is, you're bigots. You're just bigots. We know, for example, there was that one poster which was put up, that sort of now infamous poster, with the sort of thousands of people streaming in through some border post, I assume.
Mm-hmm.
And it essentially kind of said, look, is this what... I don't know.
Breaking point.
That was it. All right. So it made the point that essentially...
Nigel Farage, who was the leader of UKIP, posed in front of this poster. And on the same day, a Labour MP called Jo Cox was murdered in her constituency. And it took, I think it was less than 24 hours for the blame, in effect, implicitly or explicitly, to be put on Nigel Farage for that, which
there's no link.
It's not that there's no link. I mean, it's outrageous opportunism. I mean, really, that is gutter politics. But I mean, I think, you know, I would say a couple of things about that poster. One is that I don't think it helped the Leave campaign. I mean, I think, you know, the reason why it was exploited by the Remain campaign is because they knew they could do damage with it. He also wasn't, Nigel Farage wasn't part of the official Leave campaign, and I think that's important. The immigration issue was always going to be a factor in the campaign because being part of the European Union means that Britain cannot control the number of people who come in to live legally from the European Union.
What is that? Just, do you want to elaborate a little bit on that?
Freedom of movement is one of the four core principles of the European Union. So there's freedom of movement of people, free movement of capital, free movement of services, free movement of goods. Free movement of services doesn't actually really exist, as far as I understand it. The single market and services has never really been completed. But free movement of people happens, and particularly in Britain, which never put any kind of moratorium on immigration from Eastern Europe in the early years, certainly from the EU, from Poland, from the Czech Republic. I can't remember if it's the EU, or it was 8 or 6. There has been large-scale immigration from those countries, mostly to work, and not everybody would stay, which is separate to the large-scale mass immigration that Britain has had from non-EU countries, which has also been in large numbers, which you can't really blame on the European Union. I mean, insofar as this relates to Brexit, anyone who was concerned about immigration was going to vote Leave anyway. And the challenge for the official campaign was to broaden the argument in order to get a majority of the people. So had Nigel Farage been running the campaign, had he been the face of it throughout, I don't believe that he could have built a broad enough coalition. And this is what made him furious during the campaign, but I'm afraid I just think it is true.
He's too polarizing as a character.
Yeah, ultimately, that, you know, maybe he can... I mean, UKIP got about 13% of the vote in the 2015 election. In the European election the previous year, I think they got almost 30% of the vote, so they won that. But to win the referendum, you need over 50% of the vote. I don't think there's any evidence that he was enough to appeal to such a large segment of the population, to a majority of the electorate. And I think he wasn't really willing to broaden the message. So it wasn't all about immigration.
And what about someone like David Cameron? What was his reasoning for being on the Remain camp?
I can answer this.
Mm-hmm.
It's because we'll be stronger. Fuck, what's the other one? Stronger, better, and wealthier off, or something. Better off in the EU. He said that about 5 times in every single interview.
It's curious. I mean, David Cameron, when he came into the Tory leadership in 2005, one of the things he wanted to do was to stop banging on about Europe. That was the quote, I think. So it's somewhat ironic, maybe inevitable, that it would be Europe that would bring him down. But I think there are several reasons why he was on the Remain side. One is that he staked his reputation on going to the EU in 2015, 2016, after the election, in order to try and renegotiate our terms of membership, and came back with something that was totally inconsequential, that really didn't change anything at all, which is basically an emergency break on migration, which in any event, the EU had the power to control, so it wasn't really a break at all. But I think he fell into the trap of thinking that it was all about migration. If you solved that issue, then you could diffuse Euroscepticism, which I think was also wrong. But I think once he'd staked his reputation on that, I don't think there was any way he could go back and say, well, actually, you know, I'm going to reject the deal that I came to, because I think that would have made him look a fool. And I also think he's part of that kind of, you know, he called himself the heir to Blair. I don't think he's as much as a Europhile as Tony Blair was, but it's hard to envisage him in the kind of, with the people that he associates with.
Yeah. He's one of the elites. So going along with Europe is kind of what you do.
He's kind of this, you know, soft conservative, kind of compassionate conservatism all around, doesn't really want to be dealing with the European question. Whether he really thinks the European Union is a positive force, I don't know, but he certainly seemed to think there wasn't anything to be gained from leaving it, or maybe that he didn't want to be associated. I think maybe it's more that he didn't want to be associated with the kind of people who wanted to leave.
So let's talk about those people who wanted to leave, namely the party that you used to work for, UKIP. So the UK Independence Party, not on the side of the ocean, we don't hear too much about it, but I've done my research. So it's the whole mandate of the party was leave the EU. Mm-hmm. I mean, Nigel Farage has been banging on for I don't know how many decades. When did it actually start, the UKIP, as a party?
In the 1990s.
Right. And ever since then, it's been about get out of the EU at all costs.
Yeah.
For what reason? Originally, not so much at Brexit, but originally, what didn't they like about it? Because it's a sort of nationalist party.
I don't know if that's quite right. I mean, I think the fundamental issue for UKIP at the outset was sovereignty.
Right. Or nationalism. I mean, either word.
I don't think nationalism and sovereignty are necessarily the same thing.
Yes.
They didn't want Britain to be part of a European superstate, which is not to say, I think, they wanted the restoration of the British nation state. You can have a civic conception of nationalism. I don't think UKIP ever had an ethnic conception of nationalism.
Right. I mean, the difference between sovereignty and nationalism is that if you have to get screwed, at least it's by your own government in a way, not by the EU government.
Yeah, I think that's definitely part of it. I mean, part of it, I think, that the way that, say, in the campaign it was framed was very much a kind of classical liberal argument about democracy and control and accountability. But I think a lot of it is that people didn't want to be governed by foreigners. I think that's true.
Yeah, and I think that's perfectly reasonable.
Well, that's framing, right? So you can say people don't want to be governed by foreigners, and you can equally say people don't want to be governed by someone who's sitting in Brussels, which
is a foreigner.
It's the same thing, but to me the latter sounds perfectly reasonable.
I think
the problem is the Remain camp likes to twist things a lot. So that they sound bad. So I don't want to be governed by foreigners. Just sounds like you're xenophobic, right? I don't want to be governed by someone I don't even know, have never met, or couldn't have the opportunity to meet, doesn't live in my country and suffer the same sort of results of the laws they pass as I do. That's a perfectly reasonable position to hold.
Yeah, and on the cultural side, people have concept of national identity. And
yes.
You know, that there was a very strong sense that the EU ideally wanted to erode that. Certainly in the minds of the kind of technocrats at the Commission, they would like everybody to identify as European. So that the EU would ultimately come to supersede the nation states of Europe.
Yes. That's a reasonable assumption. So for UKIP itself, who were the voters, roughly? If there was a median voter for UKIP, was it the average working class who was disillusioned with Labour, or was it...
Well, it's an interesting question. Initially, UKIP was seen as being a threat to the Conservatives. it was seen as being to the right of the Conservatives. Nigel Farage was openly a Thatcherite, so it wasn't only about the EU. And it was a constitutionally libertarian party. So initially, the kind of voters that they expected to kind of prize away were Tories who were disillusioned with the kind of soft right leadership of David Cameron, I think. That's when UKIP was kind of gaining in support in the later years of the noughties. But it transpired that UKIP was actually gaining votes from the working classes in a higher percentage than the other party. So a higher percentage of the UKIP vote was working class, white working class, than any other party. So ultimately, they decided to campaign on Labour's territory. And I think that's part of what inspired a shift in tone that was much more focused on immigration.
Yeah, because it was in when was Cameron re-elected? What year was that, 20?
So it was election in 2010. That's when he became Prime Minister.
And then he was re-elected again. Well, then he won
2015,
the majority.
He won an outright majority, just.
And UKIP was the third largest party in that election, wasn't it?
Not in terms of seats, but in terms of votes.
In terms of actual votes.
Because it's first past the post.
Yeah.
Can you just explain that?
So first past the post means you vote in a particular constituency. So there are geographical constituencies across the party, and whoever gets the largest number of votes in each constituency then sits in Parliament as the member for that constituency.
So what's the moaning about then?
About first past the post?
Yes.
Well, it's that, say, a party like UKIP can get 3.9 million votes, I think it was, in 2015, and only one member of Parliament, because there was only one seat where they actually got
the
largest
majority
number of votes in that
seat.
So their votes were too spread out. But I think very few people in Britain would want to lose the constituency link completely, even though people would want some kind of more proportional representation. Because I don't think people wouldn't want to go to a party list system because of all the... You know, it's not really more democratic.
Yeah. This way you can actually... you know who the person representing your constituency is.
I think there are a couple of things about it. One is that if there's a particular national issue that disproportionately affects your constituency, then you have someone to go to. The second one is, on a party list system, essentially everybody's chosen by party leader or by party national executive, and you have no idea when you're voting who's going to sit in Parliament and claim to represent you.
It sounds frightfully like our country, Jonathan. Oh, wait, it is our country. I have no idea who sits in Parliament.
Yes. Okay, so I just want to get back to the immigration thing, because I think that it was quite controversial. I still feel like there's a lot of misrepresentation in terms of people who are either for or against. In this case, usually it's against. And it's often very difficult to understand the decisions made around something as controversial as immigration. So in South Africa, we've got immigration issues as well. And they're very complex because we've got immigrants who come to South Africa who are very hardworking people, and then there's claims around immigrants being part of our crime community, and there's xenophobic attacks. So it's quite a complex and layered situation. And I would imagine that it's not just the idea of people coming through the border that most individuals react to. It's the 10, 15 years later, or maybe sooner, in the case of terrorism, for example, that tends to make a big impact quicker. That people are generally reacting to. So you live there. Can you give us a sense of why people react the way they do to immigration?
Well, I would say about Britain, I mean, the pace of change in terms of the demographic makeup of Britain has been very, very quick. So I actually think, compared to most countries in the world, Britain has been extraordinarily tolerant towards immigrants. And I was curious, after the referendum, there were various claims that there was a kind of spate of anti-Polish violence and things, most of which was, from what the police have said, it's not really clear what the situation is. There were lots of reports of racially motivated incidents, not all of them necessarily violence, and even you don't require any evidence to report them, so it's hard to verify. But I couldn't help but think, given, you know, my own family's lineage as an Ashkenazi Jew from Poland, that, you know, we found Poland to be substantially less tolerant than I think any poll could say about the UK today. It's quite, you know, the level of tolerance has been remarkable, considering how hard it is, I think, for people to adjust to very fast changes in their own neighbourhood. So I think what Nigel Farage gets right about this, actually, is that it's really a cultural issue rather than an economic one. And no doubt at the bottom end of the wage scale, there is wage compression from having free movement of labour from countries in Eastern Europe where the average wage is much lower. People willing to live in, say, worse living conditions than the average Brit would. But there's also a minimum wage in Britain, which is pushing, which is rising, you know, almost year on year now. So, which is raising wages at the bottom of the market. I'm not convinced that it's really about wages. I think it's cultural. And the cultural question is, you know, to what extent do you want to see, do you want to feel like I think there are people who feel like a minority in the city or the neighborhood.
So Britain's not Britain anymore for some people. I suppose Tommy Robinson's an example here. He would argue that, I know he's a controversial figure, but he would argue that Luton is no longer the kind of Luton that he grew up in or that his parents grew up in, because he feels that there's a cultural move in that community which has changed the sort of nature of that town.
Yeah, I don't know if I would call Tommy Robinson a kind of profound thinker on the subject. And he is a rabble rouser. I mean, I get the impression the English Defence League is essentially, you know, football hooligans. But I mean, that's...
Yeah, although just to stand up for him for a second is that he was part of the English Defence League. In fact, he led it, as far as I recall. But he did leave the organisation because he felt that they were too far right and that they were essentially bigoted. And
I think he was hounded. I can't remember. Was he hounded out? Or was he receiving death threats or something? He joined an organisation called the Quilliam Foundation, I think.
No. He's against the Quilliam Foundation.
But he joined them briefly, didn't he?
No. That's Majid Nawaz's.
I thought he joined them briefly. Anyway,
but almost positive he didn't. In fact, they're now mortal enemies. But because he stormed their offices recently and outed their address and everything. But you know, I do think it's fair to say that I think he moved more towards centre from that EDL position. And you know, it is unfair to paint someone with the EDL brush if they haven't been part of that movement for 7 years. Or 8 years, or whatever it is now.
Sure,
but yes, sure, he's quite a provocateur, and he does try to piss people off. Just trying to pick up on that sort of sense, you know, from South Africa, we would have no idea, as you know, you living in the UK would have no idea about some cultural shift in Houghton, in Johannesburg.
Yeah. I think there's a good book that's just been published by Douglas Murray.
Slow Death of Europe, is it?
Yeah, Strange Death of Europe. He deals with this because so there has been widespread immigration to Europe and a lot of the people, groups that come to Europe are not ashamed about their own cultural identity, and, you know, why should they be? But at the same time as there has been this mass immigration, Europe itself seems to be having a crisis of confidence. So the emphasis, certainly in the last decade, was on multiculturalism, diversity. So there was a sense that, you know, British culture was a blank slate. And until we imported all sorts of, you know, people from around the world, you know, we didn't have one. And now there is one. And there was kind of a sense of shame about Britain's past. I think that's part of what people resent, because, it, you know, if you walk around, say, Westminster, I think you'd find a lot of people, particularly on the Labour benches, who would buy into that kind of narrative wholeheartedly. But I mean, there's been a sense for a long time, even from someone like David Cameron, that multiculturalism is bust, doesn't really work, and also that it undersells Britain. You know, people have a sense of pride, even if not in their own nation, in their own culture, and in, you know, previous achievements and the general cultural milieu in which they live.
Well, I mean, there's many ways to frame this. Cameron did have a speech saying multiculturalism is dead or something to that
effect. So did Angela Merkel as
All of a sudden, she wants to ban the hijab. All of a sudden, as if, because the voters wanted it. It's odd how these people just pivot on their positions. But the thing about multiculturalism, it's not a question of having a diversity of culture. It's multiculturalism only seems to happen in predominantly European areas. Or countries.
Yes, it doesn't seem to be expected of non-European countries.
Indeed. I don't go to Saudi Arabia and try to be a Christian because I know I'll be beheaded, because they don't care about multiculturalism or my feelings. Mm. Only the Europeans are expected to care.
No, I don't go to Nigeria and try to open up the Huffington Post.
Oh, I wouldn't want, even if you paid me, I would never go to Nigeria. Jeez.
If you paid me, I wouldn't open up the Huffington Post.
So it's a double standard, and you hold Europeans up to a much higher standard than anyone else in the world. And then when they rally against the idea, they are proto-fascists. So Europeans can't actually win. You can't be a nationalist in the classical sense, a nationalist in Europe, without being called a bigot. But you must be proud of being a Sikh or a Muslim or a North African. You must be proud of your culture, except if you're European.
Yeah, that seems to be the kind of inconsistent intellectual position of the contemporary left.
And it is quite obvious for most people to see.
Well, what's interesting is there's a book by a French thinker called a novelist called Pascal Bruckner called The Tyranny of Guilt. I don't know if you've come across it.
No.
But he says that what's interesting, I thought this was a good observation, is that if you're a white European on the left, it's not really self-hatred. It's self-hatred combined with self-righteousness. So the more guilty you feel about your own civilization, the more self-righteous you can be about it. So it's a sense of original sin. It's kind of displaced.
Yeah.
If you really believe in original sin, then in a sense you believe that you're a terrible sinner. But in another sense, you believe, well, you know,
because you've identified it.
So at least you're the kind of you might be the elect. You know,
you found Jesus.
Yeah. So there was a time when you were doing Christianity right, and you could look down on other people for doing it wrongly. And that's been the Europeans have taken that into the postmodern world. And it's, you know, the sense of being a sinner makes you righteous. And any European who doesn't consider themselves a sinner is the ultimate evil.
You mentioned blank slateism, well, the blank slate, but blank slateism is, as it's referred to, which is really applied by the modern left to many, many things. So, for example, they argue that children are blank slates. So any child can grow up to be Michael Jordan, for example, because all children are blank slates. And you just have to kind of add the right ingredients and everyone ends up as an Napoleon.
Which is tantamount. I mean, it's anti-Darwinist as creationism.
Yeah, well, absolutely. That's
a good way to use it.
Yes, it is. It's anti-science. And everything leads into this. The fact that you shouldn't gender your child when they're born is also blank slateism, because it's making the assumption that there's no definitive genders or even sexes.
The whole concept of gender, I think,
is what?
Well, is part of the same thing. I mean, if gender is really a social construct, I don't understand why it mirrors the categories of sex so precisely.
Yes, well, good point. So, in terms of the blank slateism and how it is applied to culture, it would seem that, as you've kind of alluded to, the cultures within Western European countries are kind of seen as must sort of hang back, and we start from anew, and only the new influx of the good cultures, so to speak, the current popular cultures, are what we should add into our mix. Is that a fair assessment?
Well, I think a lot of people on the kind of on the hard left, on the kind of left that you find on every single university campus, do believe in the destruction of Western culture. Yeah.
And I'm just wondering, Britain's often got this guilt complex, always given this guilt complex, because Britain colonized the entire world, or most of it, essentially, together with France and a couple of Dutch colonies. And it was a very large empire at one point. And that this all seems to, it's now meant to have this great guilt. And I suppose in having that guilt, and you speak of the original sin, but in having that guilt, it must now say, well, we acknowledge that we did all these terrible things, so now you must get to colonize us. Is that kind of what's happening?
Yeah, I think there's an element of that. And what's curious is that I think there's an accusation against Britain, particularly in the American press, which obviously has a whole thing about they don't really want to acknowledge that they were kind of the British colonialists. They weren't really.
They were a British colony who kicked the Brits out.
When you read the New York Times about Brexit, they're obsessed with talking about imperialism. You know, the people who voted for Brexit were big, imperialists, and they were, they're lamenting the fall of empire. I really don't think that if you talk to the average person in one of the places that voted Leave, I don't know, Clacton or Sunderland or something, they really care about empire. I think that's totally absurd. I think to a certain extent there's an element of isolationism. You know, people don't want to be colonized themselves. I don't think that reflects a desperation to go out and colonize. So this kind of the idea that what's interesting is that for the left, empire is a huge thing, but it's not actually mirrored on, you know, what they consider to be the right. I don't really think there's anyone in Britain who kind of is desperate to return to the days of empire.
No, I wouldn't suggest that at all. Although I would say that communities and nations are more than happy to often be colonized, certainly in modern times, in this sort of last century or half a century, are more than happy to be colonized by ideas or things that they think are good. So McDonald's might not be good for you, but as a food, but it's colonized large swathes, and that style of food in terms of fast food, etc., has colonized the world. And no one's at any point gone, well, this is terrible, because people have gone, well, that's we want this.
Well, some people
equally.
You do find kind of, I don't know, what were they called, paleo-conservatives or something, who will complain about the cultural effect of globalization.
Yes, Ramon wanted to be a paleo-conservative at one point.
Well, it depends how I identify on the particular week, but nevertheless, sorry, carry on with your...
So yeah, I don't think...
I'm just...
I don't think that it's in, I mean, I think you probably could find people who resent that, but I don't think there's a majority sense we want McDonald's to disappear.
Yeah.
What's interesting is even in France, you know, McDonald's is... I think there's more McDonald's in France per capita than...
France has been colonized by McDonald's.
Yeah, and there are people kind of amongst the intellectual classes who complain about it. But on the other hand, if people didn't want it, then they wouldn't eat there, would they? So no one's forcing you to buy
McDonald's.
Well,
London's been colonized by Apple iPhones.
Yeah.
The point I'm getting to really is we have a politician here who recently got in big trouble for saying that the legacy of colonialism is not always a negative one. So you can take things that colonialism leaves behind and you can run with them and you can choose to make something positive out of them.
I mean, I think you could certainly point to several countries around the world that were British colonies that seem to function pretty well. I mean, Canada, Australia might be the top examples of that.
Goodness gracious. We won't dox you
States.
Because there might be riots if you stay in the country for long.
It's an interesting point, actually, that no one's ever raised, which is...
So it only applies, it's only valid if they colonize white people, and those white... No, they didn't colonize white people. So the Brits colonized Australia.
Killed off many Aborigines. Well, the Australians killed off many Aborigines.
Right, and then the Brits moved to Australia, and then they became indigenized, or whatever you call it. And then they kicked out the empire and became Australian.
Although they never really kicked out the empire. They got quite a good link
with the Queen is still the head of state.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's just an interesting topic, and it's always... interesting to get someone else's point of view, because we're trapped in the middle of these politics, which gets quite intense here. And for someone who's an outsider who doesn't have to buy into a lot of the, well, here we have just a ton of race baiting that goes on around all these things. So any topic you mentioned is immediately in reference or immediately referenced towards black versus white or power dynamics. Which wouldn't be the same power dynamics in the UK, for example.
Yeah, I'm not sure what the relationship between the kind of general British population and colonialism is. I mean, there was huge opposition to the Iraq War. And I think, you know, whether it was from people on the left who really thought it was a colonial project, or I think people more generally who thought, why are we getting involved? I suppose there has been a shift in that sense, that people don't really think we should be getting involved in foreign wars, and I think there's very low public support for what David Cameron called dropping democracy from 10,000 feet or whatever. I mean, whether you could really describe that as a colonial project, I don't.
He had some pearlers. I didn't realize he was coming up with these cracks.
Well, you didn't realize he was such an idiot. He always has been.
So. Well, the idiot part. I prefer him to Blair, if I'm honest.
It's
marginal, but still.
It's hard to tell the difference.
It's choosing between gonorrhea and syphilis. Which one do you prefer?
there's the anarchist.
But now, let's talk about Muslim immigration in particular.
Sure. How are you going to
No, because Tommy Robinson was on a podcast, and he says, You know, he's actually friends with Muslims, believe it or not. He's got that one Muslim friend that makes him non-Islamophobic. But he just describes that, for example, in Luton, where he grew up, the imams in the mosques actually commit hate speech on a daily basis. Mm. And no one in the council or the local police chief or the newspapers seem to really care for fear of being called racist.
Or maybe they don't.
Is that quite pervasive? Or
I mean,
it's Tommy Robinson, and I know he's got his issues.
And I think I would say that what the West considers to be moderate Islam, as kind of the center ground within world Islam, clearly is not the center ground within global Islam. I mean, if you look at every Islamic state in the world, whether it's Saudi Arabia or Qatar or Iran,
yes,
or, you know, most of North Africa, I mean, these are states that you would say haven't Islamist ideology underlying them, and yet, you know, these are the world's majority Muslim states. This is where ideology is exported from. So I think it's hardly surprising that in, you know, what I guess is, you know, the provincial parts of the Muslim world in Europe, that the same things are being repeated by preachers there. And I'm not sure why the expectation is that somehow, you know, the center ground is moderate, and these people, you know, like all of Saudi Arabia, are the fringe. No, the moderates are the fringe. I think there has to be some kind of acknowledgement.
Well, Majid Nawaz does not represent the average Muslim person. He is on the fringe. Even people who are
He's very much on the fringe because he's a reformer.
But even people who are moderately Muslim and who do like have a little tipple of alcohol despise Majid Nawaz.
I think it may well be true that the majority of Muslims in Britain are not that ideological. But I think what's definitely false is that the ideology itself, if you were to go to, I think, you know, the Finsbury Park Mosque, if you were to go to the Regent's Park Mosque, you know, that you would find moderate ideology there. I mean, you know,
sure. But they don't seem to be prosecuted for speech, right?
Well, I mean, I don't know. There have been several that they've tried to deport. And then it's come to the European Court of Human Rights. It's taken forever. So it was
the name Abu Hamza.
Yeah.
Hook hand. He had a hook for a hand, right?
There was another one as well whose name also escapes me.
Right. Because, I mean, I think that is the underlying problem. There appears to be a double standard once again, inconsistency. The police will arrest a white working class Brit for so-called hate speech on Twitter. Right, for saying something quite abhorrent on Twitter, but they will never go into a mosque and arrest the imam for saying kill the Jews.
Yeah, certainly rarely, or maybe it's because I don't know what would happen if you actually obtained a recording and you went to the police with it, and what would follow. But I mean, I think it is probably true that it's that kind of thing is so pervasive, and certainly when surveys have been done, the kind of attitudes you find in general,
right,
are, you know, would be considered pretty racist in any other part of the population.
Very much so, yes.
What is the state of freedom of speech in the UK?
Well, I wouldn't say completely non-existent, but I mean, I think this is the thing. I'm not sure you may agree with it. I'm not sure I necessarily favour prosecution.
I don't either.
Because it's very hard to define what incitement is. But I think there should be honesty about what's going on.
Indeed. And there isn't. Or there appears not to be honesty.
But I think in England, the question of free speech, there are various things that limit it. I mean, England has some very strict libel laws to the extent that you have what's called libel tourism, I think it's referred to. So people will come in order to fight libel cases in the UK because it's easy to win them. I think the presumption of proof is on the defendant. As in, if you make the accusation,
if you say you have committed libel against me,
then you have to prove that
you didn't, not that you did. I don't have to prove that you did.
I think that's right. I mean, I'm no lawyer.
Yeah.
I think that's right.
I think that is correct based on what I recall from the UK. Okay, let's get a little bit back to Brexit. All of these issues obviously feed in, but we're over a year past the vote.
Mm-hmm.
Theresa May calls an election, which she thinks is a good idea at the time, then doesn't really campaign, refuses to participate in debate, against probably the weakest Labour leader in, I don't know, a century. Jeremy Corbyn is just horrific. There's a cult around him. Don't get me wrong. There are many people who like him quite scarily in the way that they are devoted to the man. But I think he just is terrible in many, many ways. He's done things, said things, and stands for an ideology which would be potentially catastrophic for the UK. And she runs an election and somehow manages to not lose the election. So that's important for people to understand. She still won the election, but she lost many seats, and it was a lot closer than it should have been. Mm. And now Brexit negotiations have started. Obviously, look, I'm relying on mainstream media mainly to decipher what's going on. It seems like it's quite in limbo, and nobody knows really how it's going to work out. So where are we?
I tend to think that's exaggerated. So it's curious that they say that history is written by the victors, but I think this is a very clear example of a case where history is written by the losers. So a lot of the print media in the UK and internationally has covered Brexit negatively during the campaign and even more negatively afterwards. But I think the idea that Brexit's not going to happen, I think is pretty fanciful. I mean, the basic point is this: Article 50 of the Lisbon Treaty, which begins the 2-year process of exit, you know, that was triggered in March. So now that in 19 months' time, with or without a deal with the European Union, Britain will no longer be part of the European Union. And, you know, negotiations are happening on both the exit and future arrangements, which will relate to trade. All sorts of divisions are now being talked about in the cabinet as to what kind of deal various ministers might want. And it's well known that the majority of MPs are pro-Remain, and many cabinet ministers were pro-Remain. But the extent of these divisions seems to have been greatly exaggerated by the mainstream media. So virtually all Leave ministers accept that they want a transitional period, and all, you know, nominally pro-Remain ministers accept that we are going to leave the customs union and what's called the single market. Mm. So it seems actually that Brexit is on track. Now, the question is, you know, let's say they come back with a deal which Parliament doesn't like. What happens then? I mean, I think what has to be borne in mind is that one way or the other, we're going to leave. So if Parliament rejects the final deal, then that ought to mean that Britain would leave without a deal, which is why I think the idea that Parliament can then turn around and block it, having voted to trigger Article 50,
shouldn't be allowed.
I don't really see how it would be feasible.
Illogical.
They would be voting on a deal. If they reject the deal, we don't stay in the European Union, we leave without one. So there is no option to remain unless it says explicitly in the treaty, if you want to rejoin, if a nation that has triggered Article 50 wants to rejoin, you have to go through the process in Article 49, which is basically the whole process the new nation would need to join.
Maybe it's far more complex than I understand, but why do you need a deal? Why can't, individuals or companies just do their own deals with other individuals and companies in Europe? Why does your government need to structure a deal for you?
Yeah, I think there's an argument against managed trade. But the hope is to maintain tariff-free access to European markets, both for British exports and for imports from the EU, partly because supply chains for manufacturing goods are pan-European. So if you're paying tariffs on every single component that went into a car that's manufactured in Sunderland, in Nissan, then, you know, that car would become
extortionate,
and there'll be all sorts of paperwork surrounding it. There's also the customs arrangements. You'd want some kind of customs deal with the European Union that makes trade easier. But it's essentially an administrative question. And we would be trading, if not through a particular special arrangement with the EU, and Britain will retake its seat at the World Trade Organization, then we would trade under what are called WTO rules, which is what Europe does with the United States. And, you know, you mentioned iPhones, plenty of iPhones in the UK come into the UK via WTO rules. This is not impossible. There will be some kind of administrative teething problems because, you know, you can't expect the government bureaucracies to get this right when they get everything else wrong. But, I mean, this is not an argument against the process.
I'm just trying to think of another scenario where the media have kind of been unfair and reported things completely always negatively. Is it only Brexit, Ramon?
Yes, I think so. And,
and the entire president of the United States, right, and his entire administration.
Right. I mean, well, as I think Mark Twain said, if you don't read the news, you're uninformed. If you do read the news, you're misinformed. Mm. I think, was it Twain? I can't
remember. Just say it's Twain. He said everything poetic. And
it was a white man. It's all that matters. But nevertheless, Simon, one last question from me. UKIP imploded at the 2017 general election. Well, yes. I think it imploded. I mean, it wasn't at all popular.
Well, the two main parties consolidated their share of the vote to a greater proportion than has happened in say, recent memory.
Right. So, why is that? Is it just a case of UKIP was a one-issue party and that issue has been blown
out? I think that's part of it. I think people who are pro-Leave broadly put their faith in Theresa May. And there are also some ex-UKIPers who had started out in the Labour Party and returned to it because maybe Corbyn is an anti-establishment figure. And also, you know, what's curious is that Farage was an open, say, libertarian, Thatcherite. Certainly, maybe he didn't focus so much on that in recent years, but he, you know, he never really shied away from that on the economic side. And yet, you know, a lot of the kind of working class voters for UKIP, I think, were willing to accept that, but weren't really on the same page with him on the economic stuff. I do think, you know, if the Conservative Party or the Labour Party don't deal with say immigration issue or the various issues that UKIP campaigned on, if Brexit were softened, you know, another party will come to fill UKIP's place. I think the idea that this temporary snapshot where the two main parties have returned kind of with a vengeance is going to be the permanent state of affairs is premature, I think. But politics looks very, very fluid at the moment. The next election, if it does happen in 2022, if this government manages to survive and get through Brexit, will be fought on very different issues. And it would be fought actually on government having much more freedom to decide how the country is run. And all sorts of things could come into that campaign. But I do think, you know, there are good things and bad things that could be said about UKIP. I think people may come to miss it because it was, you know, it did, it managed to articulate, certainly for a time, an argument about sovereignty and even about immigration, which was nonetheless framed within a libertarian context, which managed to destroy the British National Party, which was a fascist party, and its share in the polls. And if another party comes to replace UKIP on those issues, I think it's highly likely that it will be far less liberal, you know, in a classical sense, than UKIP was. So actually, even people on the left might come to miss it.
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing I will miss about UKIP, but he's been gone for a while, is a chap called Godfrey Bloom.
Oh, I'm unfamiliar.
Yeah, he was quite a character.
Fascinating character. He used to quote Murray Rothbard, like a full anarchist, in the EU Commission. I think it was the EU Council, whatever it's called, the
Parliament.
Council. I don't know, it sounds like Star Trek half the time, the council and this and that, and who knows what.
Yeah, he was an MEP for quite some time.
Yes.
Yeah. So, and also Nigel Farage's flatmate.
I apologize.
Oh, was he?
Yeah.
Was he? So, so if you are listening, go YouTube, Godfrey Bloom, a fascinating orator.
Perfect. And you need to learn the difference between Star Trek and Star Wars.
May the Force be with you, Spock. I think. Is that the correct one?
Yeah, that's it. So it's the end of Ramon for today.
I don't watch children's movies because I'm an adult.
Right. You may leave suggestions on how we should deal with Ramon for this blasphemy. Ramon, final words?
Yes. Come join our France Crenier presentation on the 17th of August. Seats are very limited at the moment. We have almost a full house. So obviously we'll tweet and whatever the case might be. But if you want to know what type of country South Africa will be in by 2030, and you want to, you know, have some strategy around that, come join us. It's $500, but it's thousands of rands worth of information.
Yeah, absolutely. Well worth coming to. You can email us renegadereportmailbox@gmail.com. As always, you can find us on Twitter @renegade_report and on Facebook. Simon, how can we find you?
That's a good question.
Do you want to be found?
I write occasionally for a publication called Comment Central. So if you Google that, then there's a series of articles I've written. That might be the best way.
Great. Thank you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming in on your short trip to the country. I hope you enjoy it. Have you been here before?
Never. So it's my first time in Africa.
Well, enjoy it. Enjoy it. I hope it's a great time, and it's a lovely place. So there's no reason you won't. That's it for the week. Thank you to everyone for listening. Just final apologies to our Alaskan listener who we insulted last week, who has now threatened to bankrupt the podcast by making us send him his mug all the way to Alaska, which we know really isn't on this planet. We do apologize to him, and thank you for listening. Cheers. Goodbye.
This is CliffCentral.com.